Welcome to the 63rd A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series entitled Past Belief, Visions of Early Christianity in Renaissance and Reformation Europe, Anthony Grafton focuses on the efforts of artists and scholars to recreate the early history of Christianity in a period of crisis in the Church from the 15th to the 17th century. In this sixth lecture, entitled Constantine and Conversion, the Roles of the First Christian Emperor, originally delivered at the National Gallery of Art on May 11, 2014, Professor Grafton argues that in their retelling of the dramatic and exemplary life of Constantine, scholars and artists forged new forensic, historical, and multidisciplinary approaches. They used philological and antiquarian evidence to unpack a layered and incoherent body of evidence that exposed the apocryphal legends of what has been called, quote, an inherited conglomerate. Protestant and Catholic writers concurred in their assessment that Constantine's reign marked a radical transformation of art and religion and was thus a historical moment of great consequence. Yet one or two began to see Constantine in less dramatic terms as the human, political figure that he was. The erudition and imagination of these scholars and artists in the early modern period produced sophisticated and acute views of the early church from which we can still profit today.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for being here. I was a little dismayed to think of mothers being abandoned on Mother's Day, but my sponsors tell me that a number of those present have corsages and have evidently come here for Mother's Day, one hopes with children. So welcome to mothers and others who were here, and thank you so much for your sustained and generous attention over these weeks. On the 16th of September, 1686, the first seminar in paleography took place, a momentous occasion for people who study the kind of thing that I do. On that day, the great Benedictine scholar Jean Mabillon visited the Vatican Library, which is a great event in any scholar's life. He passed the statue of the 3rd century theologian Hippolytus, not worrying about whether Hippolytus' body is actually that of a woman. He, as we are now told, he appreciated the colorful, see, it's like the Wizard of Oz, we go into color. He appreciated the colorful frescoes of the Salona Sistina, the new reading rooms built by Sixtus V. He joined two companions whose erudition was comparable to his, Emanuel Schelstrata, the prefect of the Vatican Library, and the painter Giovanni Pietro Bellori, probably the greatest expert at the time on ancient art in the city of Rome. And they set to work to look at a magnificent manuscript, the Vatican Virgil. It is one of the most impressive manuscripts to survive from the ancient world and contains many masterpieces of late antique art. The three men looked at it with a very tough professional eye. Schelstrata's notes let us be flies on the wall listening to them as they work. It's a quarto, square in shape, written in capitals with no word divisions. The letter A is written without a crossbar. The P is not completely closed. It's full of images in color which seem earlier than the time of Constantine and perhaps belong to the age of Septimius Severus. They display temples, victims, sacrifices, biremes, Phrygian caps, clothing, and other things that belong to Trojan and Roman sacrifices. Moreover, the outlines are so perfectly executed as to point to a better and earlier period. Now, as I've said, it's pretty unusual and pretty wonderful to be able to listen in to 17th century scholars actually talking about their work, especially when you have an interdisciplinary group like these three looking at a great object from all points of view. There is, however, a hitch. They were wrong about the date of the manuscript. It was actually written not before Constantine in the 3rd century, as they guessed, but in the 5th century. And in the 5th century, as Mabillon at least should have known, members of Rome's senatorial elite, pagan and Christian alike, were still steeped in classical antiquity, in mythology and history and archaeology, and perfectly capable of commissioning and executing works like this. Ingo Herklotz, the art historian who is probably our greatest expert on Christian archaeology in this world, recently called attention to this exchange, and he noted with understandable regret that the great men exaggerated the antiquity of their manuscript. He suggested quite plausibly that Bellori, the artist, was so enthusiastic about the images that he took the two scholars with him down the wrong path. After all, Herklotz pointed out, Mabillon and Shellstrada both knew a tremendous amount about the forms and development of ancient writing. Mabillon had published only 5 years before a book that I've already shown you once, the first great manual on the history of writing, De Re Diplomatica, in which he had actually studied specimens of ancient Latin script from monuments and manuscripts preserved in Rome and elsewhere. He knew that most of these dated to later than the 3rd century. Why then did he go wrong? Well, like anyone interested in this field, I'm deeply indebted to Herklotz's work, and one small service that I hope this lecture will provide is to give an answer to that question, why these men actually made the mistake that they did. Now, the kind of work that I'm engaged in today, and the kind of work that I've really been engaged in all six lectures, is what scholars nowadays call reception studies. That's to say, the study of how medieval or early modern or modern scholars and artists and writers received materials, ideas, and texts from an early period. As the image on the screen may suggest, I'm not over fond of this particular terminology, partly because I don't like thinking of myself as an old radio receiver. But really, what bothers me about it is that it assumes a very simple and very implausible model for cultural transmission, one in which the ancient world, like the RKO radio transmitter, which I remember from the cheap television movies of my youth, sends out a message, and scholars twist their dials until they hear it more or less well. I think if there is a single point to the series of lectures that I've given, and if there's a single point to today's lecture, it's that this model of a kind of coherent, uniform message which is received more or less well in a later period is not the model that will allow us to understand the development of scholarship or of artistic use and recreation of the work of an earlier period. Constantine makes an ideal case with which to examine this question because he played a vast number of roles in early modern Europe. Some people even hoped he might come back to life, or at least be reincarnated as a modern counterpart. When John Fox published the first edition of his Protestant Martyrology in 1563, he dedicated it to the new Queen of England, Elizabeth. The first word of his letter to her was Constantine, the great and mighty emperor, who was, of course, the son of an English woman. And to emphasize that he expected Elizabeth to be the new Constantine, he put her, like a bizarre Fragonard girl in a swing, sitting in the letter C with her orb and her sword. In the real world, of course, expectations like this were rarely gratified. By 1570, when the second edition of Fox's book came out, the C and Constantine had disappeared. Fox was dedicating his work to the true and faithful congregation of Christ's universal church, and Solomon had replaced Constantine. Sad evidence that in reality reincarnation is rare. Similar processes were very common as theologians and heretics, historians and philologists looked back at Constantine. He could be anything from the man who had ruined the church, which is how Dante sees him and portrays him in the Divine Comedy, to its savior. And we'll see that there were many ways of seeing him as the savior of the church. It's easy to understand why he mattered so much. The story of his life, told by Eusebius in his History of the Church and in A Life of Constantine, as well as by other sources, was dramatic and exemplary in what was probably a unique way. And I'll just give you the outlines of the traditions about his life using the wonderful set of tapestries in the Philadelphia Museum designed by Rubens and Pietro da Cortona and a few other works of art to make them a little more vivid. I'll come back to one or two of these more analytically later on. Constantine was the son of a Christian mother from England, born to share imperial rule after the Roman Empire turned into a tetrarchy with two senior and two junior rulers. He lived through the last period of persecution of the Christians at the end of the 4th century. Confronted, and this is how the story was told, modern historians wouldn't necessarily agree, by a particularly evil colleague in imperial rule, Maxentius, who persecuted the true church, among his other misdeeds, Constantine took his legions to Italy and went to war with them. One day, as he stood before his army, a sign appeared to him in the sky. Eusebius describes it as a burning, radiant cross, accompanied by the message, "In this sign shalt thou conquer." Constantine ordered his soldiers to place this sign on their banners and inscribe it on their armor. He met Maxentius at a site called the Red Rocks outside Rome, drove him back to the Milvian Bridge across the Tiber, drove him into the river, and actually killed him. After he consolidated his victory and held the appropriate procession decreed by the Senate to the triumphal arch, which they dedicated to him in 315, he began to return the favor that the Christian God had shown him. He gave the church his own Lateran palace in Rome. He gave it land and money. He set it on the path of building the great Roman basilicas above all the Lateran and the Vatican, and he gave them enormous quantities of treasure. Later, he went off to Byzantium, a small Greek city located at the point where Europe and Asia almost touched, and he converted this into the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire. He named it, with suitable modesty, Constantinople, city of Constantine, and spent enormous sums making it as grand as or grander than the old Rome. Over time, especially after he showed his customary clemency by killing his partner in empire, Licinius, and establishing himself as the sole emperor of the Romans, Constantine took the side of the Christians more and more visibly and powerfully. He closed the temples, ended the gladiatorial games, forgave taxes which hindered the church and its growth. And he did more. He established a new calendar with a 7-day week, with Sunday, the Christian day of rest, established as the imperial day of rest for everyone from agricultural workers. When disagreements over doctrine set one Christian against another, Constantine not only convoked councils of bishops from across the empire, but presided over their discussions himself. Under him, as Eusebius told the story, paganism died and the true church flourished. No wonder that he had himself baptized at the end of his life. He was a model Christian ruler, passionate, engaged, successful, and pious. Now, Eusebius's praise of the emperor is on a Monty Pythonish level of hyperbole, which can stick in the craw of modern readers and could even stick in the craw of early modern readers. He drew on Hellenistic ideas, which had envisioned the king as not just a monarch, but a god, the whole notion of the divine emperor, and he translated these into Christian terms. So when he described the Church of the Holy Sepulchre that Constantine built in Jerusalem, he didn't hesitate to interpret it as the New Jerusalem, which according to the book of Revelation would come down from the sky at the end of time. The emperor erected the victory of the Savior over death with rich and abundant munificence, this being perhaps that fresh New Jerusalem proclaimed in heroic oracles. A learned 17th century Dutchman whose copy of the first edition of this book in Greek is in the New York Public Library left only one note in it. Sorry, it's so faint. What disgusting flattery. But in his own time, Eusebius's work and Eusebius's hyperbole had an enormous impact, especially in the Greek Eastern world. His vision of the king as divinely anointed head of the church was constitutive for a long Byzantine tradition in which the monarch was also the head of the church, and even defined the vision of God himself, since in Byzantine art, Christ tended to be portrayed not as the crucified Christ, the man of sorrows more familiar in the West, but as the ruler of all, Pantocrator, as you see him here in two separate frescoes from Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. In papal Rome, as well as Orthodox Constantinople, Constantine was seen as the model of a pious emperor. But in papal Rome, the angle of vision was different. Popes and prelates wanted to remember Constantine as the kind of secular ruler who knew his place. In a cosmos ruled by providence behind the scenes and dominated by God's representative on earth, the Pope. And over the centuries, stories developed, especially in Rome, that embodied this view. One of Constantine's contemporaries, Pope Sylvester I, Pope from 314 until his death in 335, tended to star in these. And Sylvester really deserved to be a star. He was quite a wonderful figure. Here you see him saving the Romans from a dragon whose poisonous breath was destroying the city. Sylvester bravely descended into the cave where the dragon lurked, revived the two magi who had failed to deal with him, sewed up its mouth, which you see him doing there, and saved the city of Rome. But Sylvester did more important things as well. It was really Sylvester who persuaded Constantine to become the first great Christian emperor. Constantine was tormented by the case of leprosy which he had caught. He was advised by pagans that there was a cure. He need only slaughter some Christian children and bathe in their blood, and all would be well. But being the virtuous Constantine, he was reluctant to do this and decided to send the children home. Asleep one night, he had a vision in which two venerable men appeared to him and told him to go find the Pope, Sylvester, who was hiding outside the city. He went in peace to find Sylvester, and Sylvester not only greeted him, but was able to show him a picture of the two men and identify them as Peter and Paul. These are both our only pathetic remains of frescoes which were once in the atrium of the Vatican. This is what you saw as you entered the Vatican before it was torn down in the 16th and beginning of the 17th century. So he persuaded the emperor to undergo baptism. The emperor was cleansed and cured of all of his diseases, and that was the origin of the Christian Empire, a story really directed very carefully by Christian hands. This is the story that goes into the lives of the saints under Sylvester's name, and that appears in many different sets of Acts of Sylvester, the texts which describe these events. In Paradise Lost, sin gives birth to death. In Rome, the Acts of Sylvester gave birth in the 8th or early 9th century to the Donation of Constantine, a second and much more problematic document. This was a stirring narrative of the events told in the Acts, but it ended in an even more dramatic way. Constantine, thankful for the salvation from leprosy, seeing the truth of the Christian God, not only became a Christian, he gave the church his entire empire. And the Donation narrates this with all of the lust for detail of medieval lawyers, giving you all the details from the landed estates he gave the church to provide candles for the churches of Peter and Paul, to the other lands in Judea, Greece, Asia, Thrace, Africa, Italy, and the islands that he handed over, to the pontifical supremacy over the four patriarchal sees. It's a remarkable document, detailed and extraordinarily rich in its precise emphasis on the imperial subordination to the Pope. So what we have here is not a single story of Constantine, but several. A layered story. One way to think of it is what the great classical scholar E.R. Dodds talked about when he tried to describe Greek views about the supernatural and human nature. He called it an inherited conglomerate, not a coherent body of ideas, but a messy and sometimes contradictory body of ideas. And I think it's fair to describe the story of Constantine in the same way. It swarmed with contradictions about little things. For example, what did Constantine actually see? Did he see a Cairo standing for Christ, as Rubens thought when he did his sketch for one of those tapestries that have now wound up in Philadelphia? Well, Pietro da Cortona didn't think so. He thought it was a radiant cross, as Eusebius said, and he won because it's his tapestry that wound up in Philadelphia. So there were small contradictions beyond measure, but there were also bigger contradictions. Did Constantine have himself baptized publicly in Rome or privately at the end of his life? life? Was he a Christian emperor for 30 years or something different? All of these questions simply hovered in the inherited conglomerate. Now, what happens to an inherited conglomerate? Well, anyone who's read a textbook about the Renaissance knows merely 600 years later, someone came along and said, "This is an inherited conglomerate, and I'm not going to put up with it." The someone was the great 15th century humanist Lorenzo Valla. You see his wonderful hawk-like profile here, a sharply critical reader and scholar. I often think of him, though he didn't live to see the Protestant Reformation. If he had, he would have said, as Pierre Bayle did, "I'm the real kind of Protestant. I protest against everything." And he did really protest against a great many things, particularly mistakes in scholarship. In 1440, he was in the service of Alfonso of Aragon, the Spanish ruler of South Italy, who was at loggerheads with the papacy. In order to prove that papal claims to sovereignty in Italy lacked any kind of legal or theological basis, Valla went to work and wrote a denunciation of the donation of Constantine. And this is usually the first thing that you learn about this story after you hear about the donation itself. It's a wonderful piece. Brilliantly rhetorical and forensic, Valla invites his readers into a kind of cosmic courtroom, and then he begins to interrogate the donation and its authors, and to show that the text is wildly implausible. No ruler, he points out, ever resigns his kingdom, even to a priest to whom he owes more than Constantine owed Sylvester. If a ruler really did resign his kingdom, what would have followed? Why? The Pope would have refused to receive such a thing as inappropriate, not the sort of payment that a holy man should receive for curing a good person. The senators would have begged Constantine not to give up his rule of the West and destroy the structure of the empire. Constantine's sons would have reproached him for throwing away their heritage. Each of these little speeches, Valla writes out in full. They're appealing. They're beautiful. Of course, they show that if he had forged the donation of Constantine, he'd have done a much better job than the forger did. But it's really not the territory of plausibility in courtroom argument where Valla's work seems most impressive. He rapidly moved into the world of history. And here he begins by showing that the story of Constantine and the donation was an inherited conglomerate full of contradictions, and that the more reliable sources often contradicted the more powerful statements in the donation itself. The donation had Constantine being baptized in Rome, but Eusebius, Constantine's own historian, did not. And so again and again, Valla simply cites contemporary historians, Christian and pagan, none of whom even mention what would have seemed the significant fact that the empire had been transferred to papal rule by Constantine. More radical still are the arguments that Valla makes as he tries to show not just that the document wasn't written at the time it claimed to be and in the circumstances it claimed, but that it couldn't have been written then. The document swarmed with historical mistakes, not just little mistakes, which pointed to the contradictions in the inherited conglomerate, but big mistakes, which showed that the author had no idea what early Christianity was like. In the donation, Constantine says he's guaranteed properties and possessions to preserve the candles in the great basilicas. And Valla, with his customary politeness, interrogates the author, "You miserable dog, did Rome have churches or temples dedicated to Peter and Paul? Who built them? Who would have dared to build them? As history tells us, there was nowhere any place for Christians apart from secret places and hidden dens." Even sharper was his attack on the plane of language itself. If there was one thing Renaissance scholars cared about, it was using Latin properly. To establish yourself as a scholar in the 15th century, you had to write Latin that was at least apparently the correct, beautiful Latin of a Cicero or a Virgil. And that was really hard to do. People had the Latin liturgy in their heads, which wasn't classical. They learned to spell in the wrong way, writing diphthongs where there are no diphthongs in classical Latin and leaving them out where classical Latin had them. To be caught making this kind of mistake by another scholar meant terminal humiliation. And you can see the sort of figural representation of it right there as the schoolmaster revenges a bad decision about Latin on a schoolboy. For example, Poggio Bracciolini, the Florentine scholar whom we've met before, made the mistake of letting one of his works go into public distribution without having it checked over by a great expert. Valla wrote a dialogue in which the cook and stable boy of one of his friends read the text aloud and expose its errors of syntax, grammar, usage, one after another from start to finish. It was also Valla who wrote the great Elegances of the Latin Language, the great manual on how to write classical Latin prose properly, which would be a basic work of scholarship for centuries to come. Erasmus actually summarized the entire book when he was learning to write Latin. The exercise of studying Latin with so much intensity, reading so carefully, imitating so systematically, made all Renaissance scholars conscious that an individual document is written at a particular time, by particular rules, in a particular vocabulary. But no one had cultivated this consciousness as systematically as Valla. And when he brought it to bear on the donation of Constantine, the text shriveled into ash. It swarmed with gross mistakes. The donation says that Constantine gives the diadem and the Phrygian tiara. Valla, whoever heard of a Phrygian tiara in Latin? You're talking like a barbarian, though you want me to think this is the language of Constantine or Lactantius. We have judged it useful, says Constantine in the donation, together with all our satraps. Satraps? Why do you want to bring in satraps, you blockhead, you dolt? Do emperors talk that way? Are Roman decrees drafted like that? It's a wonderful piece of both precise philological argument and absolutely scorching Latin invective. Valla wasn't always right. Imperial decrees in the 4th century did occasionally use terms that were not part of the Golden Latin heritage, but they didn't mention satraps, who were known only in Persia at the time. Valla's critique was basically extremely accurate. It suited the needs of his employer, who was struggling with the papacy, and it proved his powers to the papacy. He was promptly hired as a papal secretary in Rome, where he spent the rest of his life very happily since he was a Roman citizen. But it wasn't just an occasional piece. Challenged by patrons in Rome to explain why he'd written this shocking text, Valla insisted that his only goal had been to tell the truth, as a brave orator should. And in fact, in the body of the work, you can see that Valla didn't see just the donation as the problem. It was really the whole inherited conglomerate around it that had offended him. He condemned the acts of Sylvester as a whole, not history, he says, but a poetic and very brazen fabrication. That panel was never shown by Sylvester to Constantine. So imagine, here he is declaring that those frescoes that welcomed every pilgrim and every visitor to the Vatican were based on spurious information. And Valla even went farther. In his lectures to his students on the rhetorical handbook of Quintilian, he made clear that a scholar like him could raise lots of questions about authenticity. There was the story of Susanna, for example, the story of Tobias, the story of Judith, all parts of the biblical apocrypha, or more recent histories like that of St. George. Valla, in other words, had forged and honed a set of really sharp new tools, which, if applied to the church's inherited conglomerates, could have had a very substantial impact. Now, the textbooks will tell you that they did, that it was only a step from Valla to Erasmus and Martin Luther and others who brought to bear this kind of criticism in public. But, in fact, the story is a little bit more complicated than that. It's true that Valla was an extraordinary thinker. He'd arrived at a notion of history which was subtle, coherent, multidisciplinary, and extremely familiar to us. And I think it's best exemplified by a wonderful passage from G.K. Chesterton. Chesterton says, "If you tell me that the devil is sitting on Old Ben howling, I'll be agnostic until I've looked out the window and seen. That's possible. But if you tell me that Gladstone walked into Buckingham Palace, lit a cigar, slapped the Queen on the back and said, 'Hi, Vicky, how's it going?' I'll tell you that that could not have happened in that historical world." That's the kind of consciousness that Valla had already cultivated in 1440. But it wasn't a form of cultivation that went very far in Valla's period. His book circulated in only some 20 manuscripts until the 16th century. And by the time that it was printed and wielded as an argument against papal authority, it was actually not particularly significant because the Protestant polemic against the popes was going on many different lines at the same time. More important, it's really important to realize that the polemic about the donation was an old one, though Valla's particular approach to it was quite novel. Popes and emperors debated who was sovereign over the world right through the Middle Ages. This is the story of the investiture controversy. And again, imperialists found something questionable in the donation of Constantine. Otto of Freising, the historian of Frederick Barbarossa, the emperor, says, "What's written about Constantine's leprosy and conversion in the life of St. Sylvester would seem to be apocryphal, for the Historia Tripartita," that's a sort of standard narrative of church history, reports that he was baptized near the end of his life in Nicomedia. He didn't call the donation a forgery, he called it apocryphal, but he did make clear that he didn't see how it could be an authoritative text. And many others agreed with him in this, from dissidents to critics of the church like Dante to Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, who made a very similar argument only a few years before Valla, which Valla almost certainly knew. Medieval papalists, for their part, didn't really need the donation of Constantine to found their claims to papal authority. There were more powerful biblical texts, especially those that founded the doctrine of the two swords, which could be cited by canon lawyers when they needed to reduce the pretensions of imperialists. But the donation made a wonderful narrative. It was a compelling story. It was the kind of thing you wanted to tell pilgrims. It was the kind of thing you wanted to repeat, especially in Rome, the center of beliefs in papal authority. And it received wonderful visual form of many kinds. These are frescoes from Quattro Coronati, a relatively new church because the old one had been burnt down in the 11th century, where you see Constantine giving, that's the Phrygian tiara, he's giving it to the Pope, and here you see him acting as extrator or groom leading the Pope on his animal. In these, you see the full vision of an emperor who's totally subordinate to the Pope, vividly made clear. And in the visual and what you could call the media world of Rome itself in the 12th and 13th and 14th centuries, that was the vision that you heard. There's a wonderful marginal note in a manuscript of Otto of Freising, which says, "The master goes wrong here, for the Roman curia, with which one must agree, holds the opposite." And I think this is really what's the most important thing to realize. The Roman curia, without worrying too much about the foundation of the story, wanted to hold on to the whole inherited conglomerate. The richer, the later, and from Valla's standpoint, the less authoritative the conglomerate, the better. Now, Valla did change the nature of the debate. By going through the documents line by line, by scrutinizing the objects that they mentioned, raising questions about them, he raised the stakes. If you were going to reply to Valla, you had to do so in a way that befit the questions that he'd asked. And there was no lack of effort to do that. My favorite is that of Pope Paul II, who is clearly chafed by Valla's remark that the papal tiara was somehow fraudulent or hadn't existed in antiquity. And so, we're told by Plotina, in his pontifical vestments he outwent all his predecessors, especially in his mitre, upon which he laid out a great deal of money in purchasing at vast rates diamonds, sapphires, emeralds, chrysoliths, jaspers, unions, and all manner of precious stones, wherewith adorned like another Aaron, he would appear abroad somewhat more august than a man, delighting to be seen and admired by everyone. Another text compares him to the pagan goddess Cybele, who had a quite splendid headdress. So Pius simply gave Valla the lie direct. But other popes and the artists and scholars who worked for them mobilized a different kind of scholarship against Valla, and very effectively. In the second and third decades of the 16th century, Leo X and Clement VII put Raphael, Giulio Romano, both expert antiquaries, and their pupils to work on the magnificent visual polemic of the Sala di Costantino, the rooms of Constantine in the Vatican Palace. And these are magnificent antiquarian confections. This is Raphael's, original design of the vision of Constantine, and you see here you were seeing the cross in this case, and in this sign thou shalt conquer. It's taking place at St. Peter's itself. We're looking from St. Peter's, and he's moved things around. So that's the Meta Romuli, which was a little pyramid that was near the St. Peter's in the 15th century and then torn down. That's the tomb of Hadrian, the Castel Sant'Angelo. Over here you see the mausoleum of Augustus. In fact, they would have been pretty much in a line if you looked at them from the Vatican. So Raphael is moved them aside. He's moved the little pyramid a bit to the north and the Augustus monument a bit to the south to make them all visible. But it's a wonderful kind of charming antiquarian way of showing that this scene had actually taken place. And we've already looked, of course, at the way in which the donation of Constantine is set in a very, as long as you concentrate on the area where Constantine, dressed like a Roman, is handing over Rome to the Pope, is portrayed in a wonderful, coherent way. The antiquarian detail doesn't, of course, answer any of Valla's criticisms, but somehow, just by its weight and concreteness, it's mustered as a way of sweeping the doubts that Valla had raised aside. So, for example, here we have the baptism of Constantine. Now, there's something odd about this. It's taking place in the Lateran baptistry. But the Lateran baptistry wasn't built until Constantine decided that it could be and gave the money for doing so after he'd supposedly been baptized. That's how inherited conglomerates work. What's wonderful is again, the concreteness and detail of it. Once again, just a little bit approved. You'll notice that all the capitals are uniform and Ionic, and all the columns are the same. Actually, they were spolia from other places, and the capitals were kind of mixed Corinthian as well as Ionic and didn't all go together because they were reused. Still, you can see what's going on. Antiquarianism is being mobilized to show that this story must be true, not to argue against Valla's specific points, but to nest the story in antiquity. And that is an enterprise that will be repeated most wonderfully in the transept of the Lateran Basilica at the end of the 16th century. Here you see my favorite of all baptisms of Constantine, this wonderful body shivering in cold but beautifully turned to illustrate the way that a classical torso bereft of clothing can give Constantine even more historical authority. All the discoveries of 16th century scholarship and art deployed to give an atmosphere of coherence and credibility to the scenes which Valla had claimed never took place. Well, partly this was possible because inherited conglomerates can accept contradiction. They're as much about memory as about history, as much about coherent, beautiful narratives as they are about precise documentation. They can allow for a fair amount of contradiction without falling apart. But there's a second point as well. The curial thinkers and artists who retold the old stories did have a point. Valla demolished the document, the donation of Constantine. But even Valla couldn't demolish the basilicas. The Lateran and the Vatican and the other great structures which Constantine and his family had built for the Roman Church did show that they had endowed the Roman Church in a way previous Roman emperors had not. They had made a huge impact on the fabric of the city, particularly on its outskirts and on changing its orientation. To that extent, you could argue that there was something to be said for those who refused to go all the way with Valla, that his brilliant but narrow concentrated refutation of the document did in a way miss the larger point that the document had been created in the 8th century to record as a kind of modern memory. More important from my standpoint is that Protestant scholars bringing their studies to bear on Constantine were every bit as likely to dig into the inherited conglomerate and find what they wanted as the Catholic scholars. Take the jurist François Baudouin, who actually went back and forth between the churches. He was a skilled historian and lawyer who wrote memoranda for the Magdeburg Centuriators, the authors of the first great Protestant church history. These are his rules for the use of sources, explaining to them and how careful one had to be not to use forged texts and to interpret texts in context. Baudouin published his own monograph, Constantine the Great, in 1556. It's the first effort to look at Constantine in a historical and legal way, really to write the history of his reign as a history not just of the legend, but of precise legislation that he carried out. And it's a remarkable book, polemical like everything in this field. It begins by passing over the donation. I know this myth, says Baudouin, is so empty and vile and so distant from any appearance of the truth that I'm ashamed even to mention it, to say nothing of refuting it. Then, of course, he refutes it for a certain number of pages. What he then does, however, is to give a positive view of Constantine, which is perhaps even farther from the basis in the sources than the ones that he was concerned to refute. We know two things about Constantine in books. We know that Diocletian, the previous Roman emperor who had persecuted the Christians in the last great attempt to attack the church, had destroyed copies of the Bible. And we know that when Constantine created Constantinople, he ordered 50 Bibles from Eusebius for the new churches of the city. But here's what Baudouin says. Constantine had heard that many tricksters had tried to fob off wretched little works with fake titles to deceive the church and the Christian people. He'd heard that Marcion and other heretics of his ilk had dared in their determination to corrupt the sacred books. He'd heard that Irenaeus and other prudent doctors of the church appealed to the scribes to copy what was in the original text honestly and not add, remove, or change anything. So he collected reliable texts of the Bible and deposited them in official libraries. Not one word of this has any foundation in any source. Marcion was a heretic who had heretical views about the Bible, but we have no evidence that Constantine ever thought about him for a moment. Irenaeus did put an attestation at the ends of his book saying, please copy this accurately, don't add or subtract anything, but we have no idea if Constantine ever saw this. And we certainly don't know anything about these official libraries. What we do know is that Constantine emerges from Baudouin's portrait as a lovingly imagined ideal 16th century ruler, pious, concerned for the Bible, supporting scholars and building libraries. It's as beautiful and imaginative a vision as Raphael and Giulio Romano's, just constructed of slightly different ingredients. And it's one that avoids all of the difficulties, a couple of which we'll come to just before we close. The central point, I think, is this. The conglomerate was messy. Texts contradicted one another. There were multiple accounts of many events. But on one point, all of the texts seemed to coincide, and they seemed to coincide as both Protestants and Catholics read them. Constantine's entrance into history was something as sharp and short and radical as can be imagined. After Constantine, as we heard people saying after 9/11, nothing could be the same again. That's the sense you get from everyone who writes about him. It's as if history was Ibsen's Doll's House. You know, at the end of the play, Nora slams the door, and you know the world has changed. So Constantine comes into the world, he opens the empire to Christianity, and everything has changed. That's the vision that you get from both Protestants and Catholics, and they treat any source that doesn't accommodate that vision by the method of Procrustes, which is to say that what doesn't fit is lopped off or crunched down until the difficulty disappears. I'll just give two more examples of how the inherited conglomerate, for all its difficulties and all its torture by Lorenzo Valla, continued to survive and even to flourish. They're related ones, Cesare Baronio's great Catholic Church history and those wonderful tapestries of Rubens and Pietro da Cortona. Rubens, as part of them, was based on Baronio's work. He actually bought a copy of Baronio in Antwerp in 1620, so we know he was reading the book. Now, Baronio did not defend the donation of Constantine. He had standards. He wrote to a superior in the Oratorian community that he belonged to, who was correcting the texts he cited. It's sacrilege to correct texts unless there's clearly a typographical error or a variant. So don't modernize my medieval Latin, if you please. In another letter, he insists that he will not defend the donation. The edict of the donation is full of inexcusable lies. I beg you, please don't make me dirty my pen writing and defending lies like these, which are hateful to God, since he's the God of truth. I've seen everything that others have written in defense of the document, and I find it all ridiculous. So even in the same world that was continuing to produce fresco series that told the old stories, Baronio was allowed to tell his readers, I spare you the argument, since I can produce nothing more than what others have said, and it's tedious and pointless to repeat them, since everyone is free to consult what many have written on that question. And yet, in another way, Baronio did manage to tell the old stories. What Baronio did was to include everything. He didn't include the donation of Constantine, to be sure, but he included the acts of Pope Sylvester. And what he did was to find a way of telling every story. So when it was a question of what Constantine actually saw, he showed every possible sign that Constantine could have seen in the air, the staurogram, which is a sort of tauro, the chirogram, which is the chiro, the cross, gives every possibility before making his choice. Similarly, when it came to the story of Constantine, he told every story. Constantine was baptized in Rome. Constantine was baptized in Asia Minor. Sylvester healed him miraculously. Sylvester didn't. Sylvester killed the dragon. And what he does is to let the reader choose so that the old story, though the donation is rejected, is still there. In fact, he even found ingenious ways of conjecturing that Constantine might have given the donation after all. So his refusal to defend the donation was more rhetorical than substantive. In fact, Baronio, though knowing all of the new scholarship, managed to ignore it. Perhaps more interesting, because they're the work of people who were very up-to-date in scholarship as well as extraordinary artists, are those tapestries. In the 1620s, Rubens sent to the Paris atelier of the Faubourg Saint-Marcel oil sketches for a set of tapestries which would depict the life and accomplishments of Charlemagne. A good friend of his, the antiquary Nicolas Fabry de Peresque, witnessed the viewing of some of these cartoons in Paris in November 1622. And they impressed everybody. They were impressive above all because of Rubens' command of ancient antiquarian detail. He was the friend of Justus Lipsius, his brother was an antiquary, and when the Parisians saw his sketch for the defeat of Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge, they were absolutely astonished. They greatly admired your profound knowledge of ancient costumes, says Peresque, and the exactitude which you have rendered even the nails on the boots of one of the followers of Maxentius. Peresque himself, looking at Rubens's sketch for the apparition that Constantine saw, said, "Your version was very much to my liking because of the exact rendering of the ancient military costumes." But he also admitted, "Among those present were those bold and envious critics who were taken to criticize the smallest things, in this case the bandy legs of Constantine and his followers," which is presumably why Pietro da Cortona would wind up making the sketch that was used for that tapestry when the final set was created. Modern critics have agreed with Peresque that Rubens' work was a triumph of antiquarian scholarship, and the costumes do reveal his expertise in that domain. In fact, though, antiquarian precision was clearly not his main concern. The point was to tell this dramatic story in the most dramatic possible way. Consider, and this is the death of Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge. It's a spectacular scene set in this frame of tendrils and flowers. You see Maxentius and his men falling and writhing. Maxentius here like an upside-down equestrian statue, completely tangled with his horse and falling to his death, still glowering hideously as he had glowered in life, while other followers are about to come off the bridge with him. And here you see the Roman soothsayer with his wolf skin. There's a tremendous amount of detail. And the detail is all meant to be part of the story. This flying square, for example, is presumably part of the trap with which, so Eusebius and Baronio said, Maxentius had actually tried to catch Constantine, only to find himself caught himself. In fact, though, Rubens deliberately changed the ancient accounts in the way that the inherited conglomerate allowed in order to make this more dramatic. He portrays the booby-trapped bridge as stone and the booby trap as wood. But in fact, what Eusebius said was, Maxentius tried to cross the river which lay in his way, over which, making a bridge of boats, he had framed an engine of destruction, really against himself, but in the hope of ensnaring thereby him who was beloved by God. Maxentius made a pontoon bridge. And here, in the Sala di Costantino, you can see the pontoon bridge, the bridge of boats falling apart. Rubens knew this perfectly well, but he deliberately ignored it in order to have one bridge rather than two and to make the crash of the stone bridge the more dramatic scene. So what we see here taking place, I think, in just the way we've seen again and again, is a concern less with historical accuracy, even on the part of someone like Rubens, for whom it was a watchword, than with the drama and coherence and plausibility of this traditional story. That presumably explains why they were able to include, once again, Constantine being baptized in the Lateran baptistry, even though they put in columns from the Vatican in a strange effort to decorate it. These simply weren't the questions that interested most of those who transmitted the story. And yet, there was a change slowly taking place in the scholarly ecology, which might have led to something different. And it was taking place in the way people thought about the actual art and monuments of Constantine's era. Now, Constantine had marked a caesura, not just in the history of Christianity, but in the history of art, since the early Renaissance. Lorenzo Ghiberti, in his commentaries, says, "In the days of Constantine and Sylvester, the Christian faith gained the upper hand. Idolatry suffered so fierce a persecution that all the statues and paintings were smashed and torn to pieces, and the volumes, treatises, and drawings which had been used for training men in these great, noble, and gentle arts perished with the statues and pictures." So Constantine marked not just the creation of the Christian Empire, but the destruction of ancient art. Partly, of course, this belief based itself on the inherited conglomerate with its sense that Constantine had changed everything. But it also rested on one great classical, or not classical, object, the Arch of Constantine itself. The arch which the Senate had dedicated for Constantine in 315. For the arch, so Baronio said, so others said, exhibited in concentrated form the very change that Ghiberti noted. Not only the person skilled in the study of ancient objects, says Baronio, but anyone, however ignorant, will find it easy to judge when he sees that this work, the arch, is compounded of different kinds of sculptures, some of it of the highest quality, made with great skill, some of it very different, crude, awkward, and unpolished. The first parts are the older ones. The point was that the Arch of Constantine was compacted of two kinds of materials, friezes and sculptures from older Roman triumphal arches, partly from work done at the order of the Senate to portray Constantine himself. For Baronio, it was clear, just as it had been for Ghiberti, that the arts had collapsed in the early 4th century. But he assumed this was because all the good Christian artists had been killed in the Great Persecution, a theory which no one else seems to have taken up. The main point was this: if you looked at the Arch of Constantine, you seemed to see Christianity and empire destroying the arts simultaneously, a rapid and radical change. And many of the Roman antiquaries of the 16th century, like Lucio Fauno, had made the same point, offering their own hypotheses, in his case that it was an arch of Trajan that was from the Forum, Trajan's Forum, that was taken down to provide the materials for Constantine's. In the case of Piero Ligorio, arguing that the old friezes are of elegant invention, but the later ones made at the time when the arch was made lacked any good qualities. So the Arch of Constantine itself, which interested Baronio as it interested everyone else, seemed to show a rapid and radical transformation. It also posed a puzzle, as Ligorio pointed out. Above the little arches on the sides of the arch, there are sculpted tondi on matters like sacrifice to the gods and hunting, Apollo, Diana, and Hercules. So Constantine, who is supposedly the first great Christian emperor, was allowing pagan scenes to be put on his triumphal arch. Ligorio had an explanation. After this emperor passed over to the Christian religion, he deftly transformed the rites of those false lying gods. But he saw that there was a problem. How did one explain the transformation that took place in the arch? How did one explain its apparently ambiguous character? Baronio confronted this question at length. He printed, for example, the inscription that appears in the attic of the arch on both its south and north sides. To the emperor, the great, dutiful, and fortunate Augustus, the Senate and people of Rome, because with inspiration of divinity and greatness of mind, with his army, by just arms, he avenged the state from the tyrant and from his faction, dedicated this arch as a symbol of triumphs. And he made a very important historical point. The Senate, which had the arch built, was still pagan and couldn't profess itself to be Christian. But they knew that Constantine disliked the worship of the pagan gods and openly professed that he had defeated the armies of the tyrant with the help of the true God. That's why they put the words "with inspiration of divinity." In other words, they managed the affair so as to take account of the emperor's piety and so that the Senate, which wasn't Christian, didn't have to profess that it was. Or, as Jonathan Bartle puts it in one of the more recent studies of the Arch of Constantine, the text would have been acceptable to both pagan and Christian readers. Baronio, in other words, was willing, looking at the arch, to see it, not just at the moment when good art became bad art, but as something much more complicated, the relic of a moment when Constantine and the Senate were willing to use two religious languages at the same time, or to tread a kind of ambiguous tightrope between them. This is an analysis in which he has very few predecessors. It's extremely clever. It seems to be very much the way we would analyze the arch now. And it reflects a vision of Constantine which is much more complex than that of the inherited conglomerate. The Constantine who works with the Senate, who allows divinity to be invoked without defining whether it's the Christian divinity or the pagan divinities, is a kind of politician, someone who responds to circumstance, someone who may later push harder, but at this point is willing to go only to a limited degree. And Baronio's analysis is extremely complex and articulated. He very cleverly argues, for example, that Constantine used images of Marcus Aurelius, reused them on the arch, because he wanted to associate himself with Marcus Aurelius, a well-remembered good emperor. This is almost certainly correct. Even though Marcus Aurelius was a pagan emperor with no sympathy for Christianity. What we see here, in other words, is that Baronio, in his capaciousness, in his refusal to take sides finally for one interpretation or the other, was willing to imagine a Constantine who was more complicated, more historical, more dynamic than the other scholars around him. I'm always reminded, thinking about this, of Umberto Eco's description of the three great computer operating systems, which some of you are old enough, as I am, to remember. DOS, which is Protestantism. You do your best, and it says, we're going to close down, you're damned anyhow. The Mac, which was Catholicism, lights, colors, very friendly. And Windows, which was Anglicanism, the compromise between the two. There's certainly something in that spirit, in Baronio's willingness to imagine a Constantine who is simultaneously a good Christian and a politician. And in fact, Baronio's willingness to take account of all the evidence pushed him farther and farther in this direction. In 1576, for example, Johannes Leun Clavius, a brilliant Protestant historian who did the first book on Ottoman history in a Western language out of Ottoman sources, published the Greek history of Rome by Zosimus, a very bitter 5th century pagan who actually reversed Eusebius's history of Rome and made Constantine responsible not for the creation of the Christian Empire, but for the fall of Rome. Constantine is a blithering incompetent who had moved the armies away from the frontiers, and also as a greedy, fame-mad ruler who had spent the emperor's entire funds building Constantinople and imposed a terrible tax, the Chrysargyron, the gold-silver tax on merchants, which destroyed the imperial economy. Leun Clavius, in a brilliant defense, argues that this analysis deserves credence, even though it's the analysis of a pagan. And though Baronio disagreed, he had to come to terms with Zosimus and even managed to use his text once or twice. So in that complicated, rich set of annals that Baronius gives, you hear the voice of a pagan speaking, denouncing Constantine, as well as Baronio's own cautious analysis. The final story that Baronio gives for the arch is highly significant. As you see, Constantine began to practice the Christian religion in such a mode that he didn't immediately reject everything that opposed Christian piety, as many wrongly believe, persuaded by the cries of Eusebius. Rather, he tolerated and in part cultivated and accepted those practices of the pagans, which had become glorious because they served to teach the best forms of conduct. Here is a Constantine who looks surprisingly like Edward Gibbon's Constantine, even a little bit like Jakob Burckhardt's Constantine, though he's much more pious than either of them. He's a Constantine who is human, who responds to circumstances, whose views and programs and projects change as the environment in which he formulates them change. Now, I think by this point, it's clear that if we go back to the Vatican Virgil, we can understand why three of the most learned men in Europe were convinced that these figures represent ancient sacrifices and other similar forms of recondite learning, and in such an elegant and skillful way that they seem older than the time of Constantine. Even at the end of the 17th century, even in that age of refined scholarly techniques shared by Protestants and Catholics, the power of the inherited conglomerate remained. Most scholars still imagined Constantine and his reign as marking a radical change between a pagan and a Christian Roman world. Could not bring themselves to imagine that pagan beliefs, pagan texts, pagan scholarship had flourished as we know they did for decades, indeed for centuries after Constantine's time. And thereby, as I close, not just the lecture but the series, hangs the moral of today's tale. One more moment. The great German classical scholar Edward Frankl once remarked, "The history of scholarship does not always show a steady progress." And the study of Constantine is clearly one such case, in which Baronio, struggling on his own with this mass of texts and traditions in the late 16th century, saw briefly farther than much more learned men with much more advanced techniques could 100 years later. And I think that that's a significant point, and one that it does us well to bear in mind. For Baronio does not enjoy a good reputation in the world of scholarship. He is remembered for Isaac Casaubon's magnificent 776-folio-page critique, rather than for the 12 volumes that provoked that. And I think that that's not wholly fair. It's a mistake. It was a mistake in the 16th and 17th centuries. It's a mistake now to assume that any given person of erudition and imagination looking at the Christian or indeed the classical past has nothing to offer. A mistake to let one very negative review, even one this negative, allow us to form our vision of an extraordinary and sophisticated and enormous work of scholarship. The story of Constantine's afterlife in early modern Europe is in this way a cautionary tale, and I would like to close by giving you what I think its final moral is, and that might be a moral for the larger series as a whole. My teacher, Arnaldo Momigliano, once said, "I have learned more from Cardinal Baronio, none of whose assumptions and beliefs I share, than from many people with whom I agree on a great many things." For me, nothing is more fascinating in this story of early modern views of early Christianity than the way in which, despite ideology and assumption, despite approaches that you might think would make it impossible to make progress in the interpretation of sources, the imagination, the brilliance, and the acuteness of these scholars, Catholic and Protestant, Orthodox and heretical, enabled them to see things from which we can still profit. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.